This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It's our Health and Living segment, and today's show will be the first in our new neuroscience series called Brainwaves, where we discuss all things to do with our nervous system. Our neurons play a crucial role in how we move, how we behave, and essentially how we live. And genes play a big role in neurological functions and disorders, where we now have the technology to research some of the causes of these diseases. One such scientist who researches this is neurogeneticist Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, who started her own lab in University of Malaya investigating Parkinson's disease, a neurological disorder, as well as peripheral neuropathies. Welcome to the show, Dr. Azlina. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did you get into this field? I mean, are you one of the very few rare individuals who are in this?
In Malaysia, there are not many. There are actually a number of people who work on neuroscience from different angles, so from an anatomy point of view or from physiology, from a biochemistry point of view. There are not many that are trained in neuroscience in total. So when I first came back to Malaysia, the community, the neuroscience community was very small. There's actually a Professor Ishwa Paha at Monash University in Sanway. And he came back from Japan, bringing along his whole lab with him. So he's a big neuroscientist in Malaysia. And then there's me, and there's also a number of people at University of Malaya working on different aspects of neuroscience. There's a group at University Putra Malaysia as well. Of course, at USM as well, there's some people working on it. I got into neuroscience. Actually, when I was in school, I was interested in psychology. And I wanted to do clinical psychology or child psychology. But then the scholarship that I was given didn't recognize psychology as a science degree, and they wanted me to do a science degree. So, of course, I looked up, you know, the universities to see. And even, you know, this was way back, like in the early 1990s. And even then, neuroscience, there weren't many universities offering neuroscience as a degree course. When I looked at, you know, what it covered, it was, you know, very much like psychology, but from a science point of view. Mm-hmm. So understanding, you know, what is the mechanism in the brain that actually regulates how our neurons work, you know, to bring about how we remember things and how we move. And, you know, that was really exciting to me at the time. And then I went to University College London, and, you know, UCL is a world renowned for neuroscience research. And it was really, you know, amazing to be in that environment. So, you know, so that's sort of how I got into it, you know. And now there are many more, actually, neuroscientists in Malaysia, because the people who have been trained overseas, they've come back. And so now we're training, you know, local students to then do projects on the neuroscientists. So the number of people who actually work on it are expanding, so which is great.
What are we working on in Malaysia at the moment, which is, you know, which we're struggling with as a nation as far as neuroscience is concerned?
Okay, so we're looking at many kind of late onset diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Of course, there are many also some substance abuse issues, drug addiction, and also so childhood disorders, for example, like autism. You know, actually, amazingly, there are not many people in Malaysia who are working on autism from a neuroscience point of view. I met a mother recently, and her child has autism, and she wanted to find somebody in locally who's working on it. And I was asking around all my friends, you know, and they were like, no, we don't know of anyone. So, you know, that's something that needs to be explored further. Of course, it's, you know, a lot of research is going on across the world on autism. So those are the kind of the current hot topics, even across the world. Mm-hmm. You know, people want to understand how to prevent getting, you know, dementia and Parkinson's, neurodegenerative disorders, and also from a psychiatric point of view, you know, schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, and also substance abuse. How do you get people off the addictive behaviors, and also autism, like I said?
Of course, yeah. If only you can just go in and, you know, intercept that neuron or that part of the brain that's causing this problem. And I notice it all has a lot to do with dopamine. And that's your interest in Parkinson's. Parkinson's is a neurological disorder which is really the brain having the lack of dopamine. Mm. What got you interested in Parkinson's of all of the others?
Yeah, so Parkinson's disease, I started up the project together with Professor Lim Shen Yang at University of Malaya Medical Center. And it just so happened, really, that I had come back and I was working on a number of different projects at the time. And we met at a conference. And he said, you know, I'm working on Parkinson's and there isn't much that's been done in Malaysia. And of course, I agreed. And so I said, you know, let's get together. And he started collecting patients. And, you know, together we reviewed the literature and we look to see, you know, what is known across the world and what can we start off with. So we started off, you know, looking at simple things at the time just to see whether or not the Malaysian population was similar to what had been reported across the world. There is a group in Singapore also working on Parkinson's disease. And of course, their population is similar to Malaysians, so they're also looking at the Chinese, Malays and Indians. Predominantly, they're working more on Chinese samples. So we worked together with them in Singapore on the Chinese Parkinson's disease research. So that was kind of really it, you know, and Shen Yang and I, we identified a need to understand more about our patients and, you know, because the medical field is moving towards what's known as pharmacogenomics, and which is pairing up, you know, tailoring your drugs to your genetic profile. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's not here yet for most diseases. For some diseases, yes, like breast cancer and so on and so forth. But for most diseases, it's still in, you know, at the research stage. But in the future, that's going to be part of our healthcare. And so we need to know whether or not the drugs that are being made in Europe, in America, are going to be effective in our population. And so one of the ways you can do that is to try to understand, you know, what are the genetic causes of PD in our ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And try to see whether or not those drugs would also be relevant. I mean, for the most part, we are very similar, but there are some differences which we did identify.
Would you say that ethnicity plays a big role in Parkinson's disease?
Not so much ethnicity, because there are no specific ethnic groups in the world that have a higher prevalence of it, except if, of course, you look at population, isolated populations with many consanguineous marriages, meaning they intermarry. So, of course, if you have, you know, but that's with any disease. If you have a family history of that disease and you marry somebody closely related to you, of course, you will see that disease more and more in that family. So there are some isolated populations where you may see a higher incidence. And of course, there were, perhaps we can talk about it later, about the environmental impact as well. But there have been some geographical hotspots, but those are very rare and those are related to exposure to certain toxins. But in terms of an ethnic group, not really. Okay. I mean, it's common throughout the world.
So is Parkinson's disease related to or caused on a gene level? Is that confirmed?
Parkinson's disease, the greatest risk factor for Parkinson's disease for most people who get it is aging. As you age, you are at risk of many things, you know, cancer-related diseases, diabetes, heart disease, Parkinson's disease, and other neurodegenerative diseases are also, they also work along the same way. So the majority of people who get Parkinson's disease are above 55 years old, and those are known as late-onset PD. But we also have some families who get it much earlier when they're in their 40s, and those are known as early onset or familial Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, I mean, a perfect example is Michael J. Fox, actually.
Yeah, and Muhammad Ali is an example of, Muhammad Ali is a little bit tricky because he had brain injury.
Because of the sport, Michael J. Fox was just an actor.
Absolutely. So he was very young. So if you work on families that have many family members who have Parkinson's disease at an early age, then you can identify, and there have been a number of genes that have been identified to be causal for early onset Parkinson's disease. And actually some of those genes, when you look at them in the patients who get them later in life, the late onset PD patients, you also see some involvement. So it's, you know, in genetics, we roughly group diseases into what we call single gene disorders or complex genetic disorders. So cases like, you know, BRCA1 diseases or thalassemia and a number of other diseases. If you have a mutant gene, you know, you will get the disease for sure, right? So if you have an abnormal form of that gene, you will develop the disease. Yeah. But there are a number of other diseases where many, many genes are involved in small ways. And
that
combined,
is the problem.
Yeah, and combined with, you know, your lifestyle, your diet, exposure to, you know, environmental factors, perhaps, you know, some sort of injury or something or another, and that kind of tips it over the edge, you know. And so, you know, because not everyone above 60, 70 gets Alzheimer's,
That's
gets
right.
Parkinson's. So mm-hmm. what we want to know is, you know, the people who do get it, you know, what are the genetic factors that might be causing the development of Parkinson's disease in these people, and try to understand that further. And of course, you know, eventually the hope is, you know, to be able to intervene at some point, you know, if we know that that person is possibly has a high risk, then, you know, we could think about, you know, of course, you know, modifying lifestyle, et cetera, et cetera. But there may be drugs in the future that could help at the early stage to sort of delay it, or even hopefully to, you know, completely stop it from progressing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is the most you can do at this stage.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, who's a neurogeneticist in the studio with us, explaining more about Parkinson's disease and genes. When we come back, we'll find out more about the community work she's actually been spearheading in Malaysia. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment. Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, a neurogeneticist in the studio with us, discussing Parkinson's and your genes. A lot of work is being done, we know, world over. Little did we realize that lots is happening here in Malaysia as well on a neuroscience level. You've initiated a campaign called Genes for Genes 2016 Awareness Campaign, and you made it into the Malaysian Book of Records for the longest DNA helix made out of genes. What is that? It's genes, is J-E-A-N-S for genes, G-E-N-E-S.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, it's a play on words, really.
Okay.
The Genes for Genes campaign started off in the UK. And when I was doing my PhD there, I was involved in fundraising for the campaign. So how it works there is that offices, you do all kinds of fun things. And there's the third Friday, normally, it's the third Friday of every September. You can wear jeans to work in support of the campaign, you fundraise. And the campaign is really to raise awareness about genetic disorders and to fundraise, you know, to help with the educational programs, educational outreach programs, and also to help to support some of the families. So when I was there, I enjoyed it. And then when I came back, and, you know, if you enjoy something, you want to continue doing it.
Of course, definitely.
So, actually, there's the man who started off Genes for Genes UK, he then moved to Australia. And so there's a Genes for Genes Australia now. He coined the name. So it's genes, as in the
genes that we wear.
The genes that you wear, mm-hmm. for genes, as in genetics, genes, G-E-N-E-S. And so it's a memorable kind of name. So when I came back, it was very small. We did an exhibition, I think, on genetic disorders. And then Genes for Genes UK has a database of videos of families affected, of children affected by genetic disorders. So we screened those. And then it's just kind of grown, really. Actually, in UM, we've been running it since about 2008, really. And you know, more and more people have gotten involved. And last year was one of the biggest celebrations or campaign, I suppose, events
worldwide
that we did.
Here in Malaysia,
yeah. Before that, a lot of what we had been doing was creating awareness and not much fundraising. And then when we had more people on the team, we said, let's do more fundraising this year. So then we thought of, you know, what can we do? What would be memorable? And so, you know, there were many, many ideas that were sort of, you know, that bounced around the room. And we got some inspiration from a world record attempt that people had formed a DNA helix. So a DNA helix is basically, it's like a ladder, which is twisted to look like a spiral shape. So if you flatten it, it comes out in kind of like a figure of an eight, like an interconnected figure of eight. So we saw that some people in, I think it was in America, and also then sometime last year, they also broke the record in Russia for the longest DNA helix formed out of humans. And so we sort of wanted to do that a little bit, but then we realized logistically it would be difficult to do. So we decided to have a play on the genes. So we thought, you know, maybe we can ask people to donate their old genes, and then we will lay it out in the DNA helix shape. And so as the campaign kind of, you know, got more and more momentum, we actually worked very closely with an organization called Kindness Malaysia, and they do some amazing work, and they really helped us out in publicizing and getting all the genes in. And so in the end, you know, we had over 1,000 genes, and we thought, you know, why not try the Malaysia Book of Records? And so we successfully formed over 531 meters of this DNA helix made out of genes. And so I really do need to give a shout out to the biomedical science department, and also the students at the Faculty of Medicine at University of Malaya, because, you know, they worked to lay these genes out for, you know, 531 meters, which is no joke.
Any idea how many genes you actually had?
We had over 1,000. The idea was that, you know, because of the economy last year, it's difficult to ask people to donate cash. But everyone has, like, you know, a spare pair of jeans that you can't wear anymore, that maybe have a hole in it, and, you know, that you're willing to kind of give us, and, you know, you give it to us, and, you know, we'll make a record with it, and then we sell it off as part of our fundraising campaign.
Okay.
So it was really amazing, actually, in the last month, the support that we got, people donating many jeans.
And the funds are used for?
So the funds are used for many things. So, of course, the main aim of the campaign is to educate the public and also engage them in understanding more about genetic disorders. So some of the money goes towards our educational campaign. We also have a portion of the money that goes towards helping families. Perhaps they need a specialized piece of equipment, so we try to help them out there. To contribute a little bit, or to link them with another organization or a group who can help them to get that piece of equipment. So most of the money will go to a kind of, you know, a rolling, you know, it rolls into our effort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you think people who have Parkinson's disease, what sort of support do they need the most? Mm-hmm. And I think that's lacking. People get diagnosed mm-hmm. with either Alzheimer's or Parkinson's and dementia, and then they're given medication and sent home, and then everyone's left to sort of fend for themselves. And I think the people who struggle the most are family members and caregivers, right? So, I mean, how do we bridge that gap?
I think one very important thing is the people need to understand the disease. So if you don't know what you're dealing with, it's very difficult to know what's coming up next. So, for example, you know, you may know Parkinson's disease is, you know, the patients, they develop movement problems. But it also progresses. It progresses over time. They lose more and more of that ability to move. And many of them, perhaps at the late stage, they may end up bedridden. They also develop, some of them develop other complications, such as, you know, they can develop dementia, and then also a side effect of the drugs that they may be taking, they may develop other, you know, complications like obsessive compulsive behaviors, mm-hmm. Because the drug that most commonly is given is known as L-DOPA, which increases the amount of dopamine in the brain, which is lost in these patients. So the neurons that are making dopamine, they no longer make enough dopamine for us to be able to move properly. So if you give them a drug that's helping to increase the level of dopamine, dopamine doesn't just work in the part of the brain that controls movement. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that has many, many other functions, one of which is in a part of the brain that is in the reward system. Mm-hmm. So sometimes people who take dopamine, they may also develop some addictive behaviors because of the side effect of that drug. So I think the key to coping with the disease is really knowing what the disease is about and how it's going to progress. And once the family members know, you know, what's in store and why does that person behave that way, then, you know, you learn to accept and you learn to be more empathetic. I think, you know, for people who have Alzheimer's and dementia, for example, they're not doing it to be difficult. They just can't. Similarly with people with Parkinson's, you know, they get to a point where they can no longer feed themselves or they have very bad tremors. You know, they're not doing it on purpose. So, you know, maybe because of some misunderstanding of the disease, mm-hmm. The family members, they don't cope as well. So, you know, educate yourself about the disease. You know, there's a lot of really useful material out there online. If you look at universities or hospitals, they normally have, you know, associated websites with educational material there. Not all of it. You know, you have to be very careful about what you read because some of the information is wrong. Yeah. So, you know, you have to choose your source carefully. And, you know, with knowledge, you know, there's a mother who has children with not Parkinson's, but with a different genetic disorder. And she always says, you know, with the knowledge comes understanding, and with understanding comes support. And so, you know, you need to be educated, really, about those particular diseases and how to help your family members.
What do you say to people who, you know, take their loved ones who have Parkinson's or Alzheimer's to the neurologist and come back very frustrated and only feel like all the doctors do is dispense medication and send you home. Mm. And then sometimes the medication don't even work. And, and they almost feel like their loved ones aren't part of this experiment, really. My answer to them is we're at that stage where we really don't know. And it is an experiment. Am I correct in saying that? Maybe in 10 years' time it might be different. But at the moment, that's reality is that's where we are.
To say that the doctors, when they give the medicine, it's a form of experiment. Of course, it's a little bit difficult to know how the patient will react. Different patients will respond differently. Mm-hmm. So some respond fantastically well to that drug. Sometimes it could also be the dose is not correct. So, you know, a little bit of tweaking may need to be done. But, you know, how drugs are developed, normally they need to go through very intensive clinical trials before they are, you know, given a license to be on the market. So the doctors, they're giving the drug with that knowledge behind them, that this drug has been tested and it has, you know, a certain percentage of effectiveness and all the other side effects. But, of course, you never know how they're going to react. And so, you know, sometimes if the family members find that the parent or the caregiver finds that the family member perhaps isn't responding very well or develops other symptoms that they didn't have before they took the drug, you know, maybe it's just a matter of just going back, talking to the doctor, changing the dose, changing the drug, and just, you know, it's a conversation, really, you know, communicate with the doctor and see what can be done. You know, of course, for some individuals, there may not be a drug that works. Some family members may also think that the family member who's affected will be normal, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. So they have these sort of unrealistic expectations of, you know, what's going to happen. You know, for example, if the person has Alzheimer's and you give them a drug to help with their cognitive ability, you know, but my mother still has problems, you know, of course, because the disease itself is progressing and the drug is helping one part of that symptom, but it's not going to completely halt the disorder. It's not going to make them, quote unquote, normal again. So, you know, that's what I mean by the people need to understand really what the disease is about. You know, most neurodegenerative disorders, you know, they progress and the disease progresses, and you know, the drugs that may have worked initially, they may need to be changed, you know, at some point during the different stages. And so, you know, the family members really need to be aware and, you know, just keep up to date. Of course, you know, when you have a loved one who is ill, you want to do the best for them and you want them to be healthy again. With these neurodegenerative disorders, for example, with Parkinson's disease, they may have movement-related issues, but they are able to do many other things. You know, they may not develop dementia, so actually cognitively they are able to still converse, to enjoy their life. You just need to modify, you know, to suit the change that they have, that they're going through, and, you know, better management of the disease to help them be more comfortable.
Heart disease is the leading cause of death in this country amongst men and women. And from what I understand, catching up at a very fast rate of disease is actually Alzheimer's. What's happened? Do we know why this is the case? I mean, I cannot remember talking so much about Alzheimer's and Parkinson's or even dementia back in the day. And, you know, I'm concerned. I mean, in 10 years' time, I will be 55 and I will be part of that age group. What is going on?
Okay, I think there are many things. So, for example, we are also living longer. So for cases like these late-onset neurodegenerative diseases, you know, for example, we and the management of diseases like diabetes and heart disease are keeping us alive for longer, so that then we get to the age of 65, 70, where then, you know, we're then at risk of another slew of other age-related diseases. So because of better health management, people are living longer, and that's one of the things that can happen. Of course, there's also better diagnosis, better awareness in the case of Alzheimer's disease. Of course, we've heard many stories of, you know, my grandmother, she kept forgetting. And there are many terms that are used in the Malaysian public, like nyanyo, you know, and itu nyanyo sikit, you know.
All the time.
Yeah, and nyanyo kind of encompasses many, many things, and one of which could be dementia, right? But then people always used to just think it's a part of normal aging.
Yes.
But of course we know that, you know, dementia is not part of normal aging. You know, of course, everyone gets memory loss to a certain extent. But dementia is very different. Actually, recently there was a study that showed that they could track whether or not people were going to get dementia by the fact that, you know, when you forget, you know that you've forgotten. But in dementia, you forget and you don't realize that you've forgotten mm-hmm. something. And so when they did this study, they found that you could actually capture these people. And if you followed them, you know, over a number of years, you could actually predict those that did poorly on the test, that that they didn't realize that they forgot something, that they then, you know, went on to develop, you know, dementia.
Mm-hmm. Is dementia caused by lack of dopamine or is it just brain atrophy?
Dementia can be caused by many things. So lack of dopamine is specifically for, you know, loss of dopamine doesn't just cause Parkinson's. Parkinson's is due to dopamine loss. If you have loss of dopamine, you can have many, many other types of disorders. So Alzheimer's disease or dementia in general can be caused by stroke, brain injury, many, many multifactorial cases. Sometimes it's even, you know, exposure to environmental factors. You know, if you had mercury, for example, has been implicated. and pesticides, you know, and food additives, etc. So of course now, you know, we're much more aware of, you know, for example, plastics don't have BPA and don't put mercury in your mouth as a, you know, filling for a cavity, for example. But, you know, when our parents or when our grandparents were growing up, you know, people used to use it all the time and you never realize. So, you know, because of that, that is partly why they have developed that disease at the moment. But, you know, coming back to the question of as to whether or not it is, we're getting more cases. I think it's, number one, people are just more aware of the fact that you have a disease like Alzheimer's or dementia and that there are possibly drugs that can help. Last time, if you had a, you know, old makcik in the kampung who was nyanyo, and you, if you thought nothing can be done, you're not going to take them to the doctor. But now people know that they can do an internet search and they know that there is some medication, so they will bring their loved one to see the doctor to see whether or not it can help to improve the symptoms. And so the doctors are seeing more, so they're reporting more. And also, it's being labelled better. So last time, maybe it was just nyanyo or it was just, you know, ala didah tua, you know, she's just a bit old, dia cepat lupa or something like that. But now you can actually give them a proper diagnosis and manage them better. So that is also, I think, giving the impression that they're more. Just like in autism, people find there have been many reports to say that they think that more and more people are born with, not more and more people, there's more cases of autism. Yes. But, you know, that might not be necessarily true because, you know, in school, you know, we can think of maybe a number of children that we, our friends in school, who had learning disabilities. And perhaps now, if they were diagnosed, perhaps they fell within the autism spectrum.
In fact, they weren't even in school.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were left at home, kept at home. And so I think in the autism field, people recognizing it and the parents are being a little bit more proactive because they feel that something can be done. Whereas before, they just sort of thought, you know, perhaps there was a problem during childbirth and you can do nothing for the child, whereas now people are more educated. And so they're bringing their children or their loved ones to see the doctor more. And so then the doctors are then reporting that they're seeing more of these cases. But it may have already existed at that prevalence already, but just not officially recognized. Yeah.
Do you think it's important for academicians like you to branch out from bench science and engage with the community? Because, you know, it's awareness for the rest of us, really.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
it's always a challenge communicating science to the public.
Yes.
not many people can do that.
Yeah. I think it's really important to reach out to the community and because of many different reasons. I think, you know, it helps as a scientist, as a lecturer, it helps me to understand the diseases that I'm working on, that I'm teaching about, so that I get a better picture about what's happening. And you can stay in the lab and work on cells and work, manipulate, you know, different things at a nano level. But unless you really know how that's affecting the individual and the families, you know, you do yourself a disservice, I think, if you don't go out and see the families. I think it's very important to educate myself, so that I can then help to pass on the knowledge to the university students that I teach so that they are more aware. Because, of course, they are going to become parents or they are going to have friends who have children who may have these disorders. So, you know, that's part of my awareness as a campaign as well, that I need to make them aware because they will be the movers and shakers of the next generation and they will be educating their children, etc., etc. So they need to know. And also, I think in my case, for example, you know, I was given a government scholarship and taxpayer money to pay for my education. So this is me giving back for the money that was spent on me. I think because of the way science was taught in school, maybe they were turned off.
Yeah.
But actually, you know, science affects us in everything that we do. And it's also a responsibility of the people who are knowledgeable to pass on that information to help the community. Because, you know, we all work together to form one community, and you help the families to understand the science or the community to understand the science behind the disease or that particular characteristic, and they teach you something as well. And so, you know, you work, you know, synergistically to help future generations, really.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on. Thank you for joining us. If you'd like to catch Dr. Azlina, she will be at our BFM Health and Living Live 2017, which is going to be happening on April 8th at the Sime Darby Convention Centre. For more information, just log on to bfm.my/health. She's going to be part of the panel that's going to be discussing dementia, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. So thank you again for joining us, Dr. Azlina Ahmad Anwar, a neurogeneticist, discussing Parkinson's disease on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.